talk about trusted systems. This is an opportunity to have a number of aspects of the course come together and just to see how much people are generally caught up on such things. Lauren, there you are. What's a trusted system so far to you? Use your robot to give you a safety voice.
It seems like a way for music companies and other people who don't want things freely distributed to use technology to keep that from happening.
And what makes it trustworthy?
Couldn't quite figure that out. I think it's because they can trust it to do what they want it to do, to keep certain parameters. You have to be somehow authorized to do certain things.
So this is a bonus question, not so great, but can you think of an example of a trusted system in your daily life using the definition which just came up? Can anybody think of a trusted system? Forget about the internet, just a general system that can be trusted by the manager of the system as against the person using it. Amanda.
Bank. You trust the bank to keep your money for you
Alright, so it's a bank, a trusted system. I suppose it's trusted in a colloquial sense that you hope that the owner of the bank doesn't take the money you fork over into your account and run away to a foreign land.
Sort of like...
The agreed protocol on both sides that you won't try to access more than is your money. I mean, you probably wouldn't succeed at accessing more than your money, but... I mean, it's sort of an agreement that you'll both conduct business in a certain way.
Right. I guess the question I would ask, reflecting on your example, which I haven't thought about before, would be, are there technological mechanisms in place to stop the bank owner or the teller from walking out the door with your money? If there aren't, you would say that the owner or the teller are not subjected to a trusted system. Instead, there are other rules, maybe laws, maybe agreements designed to keep them honest, but it's not the technology doing it. And in the case of a bank, not only leaders of the bank as well as I probably should. I can't say it. Maybe there are trusted systems so that tellers can't just grab a bunch of money and walk out the door. Maybe there aren't. Anybody else think of just a trusted system? Yeah, Katie.
Is the rotisserie?
Is the rotisserie a trusted system? Right. Yeah. I think rotisserie is a trusted system. I tend to be a pushover as people go. And yet, once having created this monster that is the rotisserie and the bot, if somebody tries to turn the leg answer, it simply won't accept it if it's past the deadline. And you can send a message to the health people that says, you know, I just tuned in at 7 p.m. and it's oddly, I can't get my answer to the bot. What's wrong? And the answer is the system is keeping you honest, as the system knows how. And yes, it's subject to flaws. We've had a terrible time with it. Are you simply aware that you have a data flaw now turning your trusted system answers operations? You have until 8 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Time. You have to fix the clock on the clock as well. Thank you, Rachel Valenti, for pointing that out. Yes, I would think the rotisserie might be a kind of trusted system. A couple other examples that I found that maybe are useful to get thinking about would be a taxi cab meter. That thing is up front with the taxi cab driver, even when you're not in the cab. And yet, in the city of Boston, as we know, there is a wax seal bearing the imprimatur of King George to show that that meter has not been opened in a long, long time. And you can trust that the number that appears on the meter is, in fact, reflecting the Byzantine formula established by the Taxi and Limousine Commission, which here is a wing of the police department, as to how much you are to be charged for the trip. Now, in Ecuador, they have gotten around the trusted system of taxi cab meters by simply putting smaller tires on the front of the car so that it rotates more for every mile driven. But Boston hasn't gone on to that yet, so the trusted system remains uncracked. Gas station pumps, right? There are a couple people employed by the city of Cambridge wandering around with gas station pumps, putting stickers on them to say, I have inspected the pumps. And the Duff Light is coming from the Duff Light low octane, and the Duff Strong is coming from the, you know, super duper octane, and the Duff Medium brew of gasoline is coming from the middle pump. And my sticker here shows that, and hopefully when I leave, it'll take off the sticker, switch to the smell around, and give you the same gas no matter what button you push. So that's a kind of trusted system. As might even be the scale of the heart. There's actually a sticker on the scale of the heart so that the heart people, as you check out, the only way they can cheat you is to stick a finger up and touch the scale as they weigh your salami. But the scale itself has been certified by a professional scale inspector to weigh salami according to the laws of physics and not the laws of the market. So there are all sorts of trusted systems in the world. And yeah, I think we've had a couple of good examples of some that are now possibly in play on the internet to start controlling the distribution of music. So I wanted to start off, as has now become traditional, with a few charts and graphs to add a patina of respectability and substance to the course. You might remember this one. You may not remember anything about what it means, but you may remember this picture. Let me try to translate this picture, which takes a lot of explaining, even if you've already seen it, into a format that is distinct to our trusted systems debate, and in a way is a nice kind of modular review of the copyright issues we've been talking about. So here we are. Here is a spectrum. And the spectrum has on one end less constraint, and on the other end more constraint. These are the possible things you can do in the world, you being whoever you choose to subject to this spectrum. So suppose, in this case, we choose to make you the consumer of intellectual property. You are the consumer of intellectual property, and how easily you can consume it, define consume how you like. Copy the stuff, carry the stuff around, transfer it to a friend, make a derivative work, all the stuff we've been kind of hammering on time and again. That is somehow represented along the spectrum. And I have, luckily this has turned up again, I left it in the room yesterday. It turns out these are $250. I guess I shouldn't say that, but it's back to me. It has no use to you unless you have an LP770 projector in your house. So, okay, or if you want a laser pointer. So there's less constraint and more constraint. Here we have AD1400. This is what some of you, I hope, recognize as the monastic manuscript era. So if you are a consumer of intellectual property, the range of plausible behavior in which you can engage, thanks to the way the world is over here, some arbitrary point along this de-unitized spectrum between less constraint and more constraint. And what's represented here is, here's the sort of range of stuff you can pull off with intellectual property. You can make some copy of it, but it's pretty hard. If you're fairly constrained, because you've got to sit down with a quill and make a copy laboriously of a given piece of work that may be written down. So there is some range of behavior you engage in, but it's somewhat limited just by the facts of life. That's the range of plausible behavior in which you can engage. Let's move ahead to 1456, which is the Gutenberg era. But first, Becca has a question. Yes? Oh, great. So that means you can go back to MSN. And you should, you just figured it out. Great. So feel free, as this unfolds, to type in those real-time comments and questions at cyber.mozart.edu/is2000/ask. And we might have Ben over here, too. Those things are just getting better all the time. I don't think I'm going to. This ain't broke, so I'm not going to fix it. But let me know if there's an interesting comment you want to play. Okay, so here we have the Gutenberg era. Gutenberg invents movable type, and the argument goes it suddenly becomes a lot easier to copy stuff. As a result, the range of plausible behavior increases. You can certainly sit around here and be very constrained if you want. You can choose not to make copies of what you have. But suddenly, there's a lot more you can do in here thanks to a sea change in the technology. And so the argument goes, because there's a lot more that can happen here as a consumer, there are other parties in the world not very pleased to see that happen, namely the people that hope to get paid for producing intellectual property. So according to this traditional story, we then start invoking law. And this moves our clock forward at least to AD 1900. And at this point, we've established some legal boundaries. In the United States, we call it Title 17, the Copyright Code, to start saying, yeah, it's true that this is your range of plausible behavior. We can't stop you in the sense of you could build a printing press and start cranking out copies. You can use other technical means, ultimately, say in the 50s, you could add a Xerox machine and make these copies. The range of plausible behavior hasn't changed any. Technology is here. However, we're trying to draw a legal boundary in it. And those red dots are meant to either appeal to your sense of being a law-abiding citizen, or to threaten you with some kind of punishment. If you engage in this behavior that you can do, we will punish you if you fall on this side of the line. The legal boundary is imposed to approximate what the old boundary used to be before we got into the era of the Gutenberg press. Is there any real-time comments or questions? I'll take that as a no. They're just like goofy comments and stuff? Oh, right, okay. All right, so we have a legal boundary come up and start to impose some limit. And this is where our vocabulary even is somewhat tested. I mean, you can just choose an arbitrary vocabulary to talk about this as long as you stick to it. So, for instance, there's one guy who says, I think this is how it says it, it's either this or the opposite. He says, you are, if you're in this zone, you are free, you can copy something, but you are not free to do so. Right? You can do it. The technology lets you, but you're not free to do it because the law prevents you. It's such a clumsy vernacular, you can just easily agree that what we mean is you are free to do it, nothing stops you, but you can't do it because the law prevents you. It's just inconsistent if you're going to throw around words like that. Okay, so that's AD 1900. Now we push ahead to AD 1994. Now we hit the era of promiscuous publication, the internet era. And this is really, in a nutshell, what our entire class, or something, three classes on Napster was about. It was about the fact that thanks to this internet, cheap networks, cheap storage, unruly kids, the range of plausible behavior has just gone out of control towards the direction of less constraint. This legal boundary still exists, but it's more porous than ever before because of other technical features that make it so that you can't get caught and there's too many of you, etc., etc. So you get a whole bunch of activity on the other side of the legal boundary when the economy and certain powerful actors have gotten used to there being a certain bleed through here, but not too much. And in AD 1994, this is what the internet is bringing us, increasing freedom through technology or anarchy through technology, depending on what vernacular you care to use. So let's just see. I've actually extracted just a hammer in. This is because it's really where we're at, of course, right now. What some of those views in 1994 were. Here we are from the LA Times. It says, digital double trouble. This is in 1994. This is just as the web is happening. With silicon microchips, an exact electronic replica can be made of virtually any medium, images, sound, or data. The February cover of Scientific American magazine, for instance, featured a digitally altered photograph that showed Marilyn Monroe flirting with Abraham Lincoln. 2 years ago, pop singer Paula Abdul hooked it up with equal Gene Kelly in a Diet Coke commercial, thanks to digital imaging. Armed with personal computers and digital recorders, entrepreneurs around the globe are using digital technology in more foreboding ways. It seems to me that that's a somewhat foreboding way already described. But they are making unauthorized copies of billions of dollars worth of music, movies, software, pharmaceutical formulas. Anybody got a pharmaceutical formula on the web yet? And other so-called intellectual property. And thanks to the growing matrix of global computer networks, they can zap the appropriated words to consumers around the world in seconds. So this is apparently the double trouble to which the LA Times refers. And they say such technical feats are testing the effectiveness of U.S. patent, trade secret, and copyright laws. Challenge comes amid final consideration of a new global trade accord that's supposed to extend IP protections that help generate more than $50 billion a year for the U.S. music and film industries. This is why Jack Valenti has a passion for this subject, which I hope you'll all hear on Sunday. The spread of digital technology is quickly eroding the political and geographic boundaries that allow industry companies to maintain control over information through legal means. So this is it. This is the LA Times just describing our chart without even having seen it. And ditto, the New York Times, according to leading figures in the arts and humanities, technology is fast outpacing the law. The unauthorized copying, manipulation, and sale of creative property at home and abroad are disrupting licensing structures that date to the founding of the American Republic. The pillars of the Republic are starting to shake under the strain of America Online. Okay, this is from the Christian Science Monitor, more liberal publication, who pays for what on tomorrow's internet. It's a thought that strikes terror in the hearts of entrepreneurs. What if their visions of online commerce turn out to be a mirage? What if all the information they hope to sell on the so-called information highway is free? That threat is real enough that publishers, technologists, and legal scholars have begun a raucous debate. Their focus is how to protect copyrights in cyberspace. And sure enough, here is one element of that debate from a law review that is typical of the time. Telecommunications, footnote, and the information superhighway, footnote, facilitate instantaneous mobility of literary and artistic works in the form of text, video, and audio recordings, footnote. With the click of a mouse or the tap of a key, virtually anyone with a computer and a telephone can obtain vast quantities of information from almost anywhere on the globe. These conditions pose a start page, formidable challenge to the international protection of intellectual property. In other words, it's a disaster. And we have Barlow happily adding fuel to the fire. And you'll recall this, is what was assigned that first week, and we were stoking the fire in this very class. Legal efforts to keep the old boat floating are taking three forms: a frenzy of deck chair rearrangement, stern warnings to the passengers if she goes down, they'll face harsh criminal penalties, and serene, glassy-eyed denial. Intellectual property law cannot be patched, retrofitted, or expanded to contain digitized expression. Any more than real estate law might be revised to cover the allocation of broadcasting spectrum, which in fact rather resembles what's being attempted here. We need a new set of methods to convince this entirely new set of circumstances. So here is a review of Barlow, Ed 4 from Lawyers Weekly. The lawyer's response: since I read a column on IP, my attention was naturally caught by the words, "Everything you know about intellectual property is wrong," on the cover of the large issue of Wired. Here's a full title of the article by John Craig Barlow, who is, according to a short blurb, a lyricist with a grateful debt. Notice that he's advertising. He didn't know that before he read the article. Okay, he says, the thesis of the article, as far as I can make out, is that copyright and patent laws are outmoded because it makes our physical embodiments and ideas that are meaningless in the age of high tech, with the onset of digitized information back and forth over the internet, or whatever you want to call it. In the end, I concluded only that Mr. Barlow has to consume more than his share of the goods. So there's a lawyer saying, Shayna, this is the same old stuff. We've just got to rearrange some deck chairs and have harsh criminal penalties for those who allow the ship to go down, and everything will be just fine. All right, so this is where we were in AD 1994. The range of possible behavior is up. The legal boundary is becoming more porous, and people are starting a raucous debate. And in a way, the beginnings of this class have echoed exactly that sequence of events. So now at last, we can let go and drop the other shoe. And what is the other shoe to drop? Oh, there's an attempt to make the boundary more porous. God, I didn't know a slide was going to come next. Just stay. So the next step of this is to somehow put trusted systems into the picture. So just to see if these pictures have any meaning whatsoever, somebody tell me, Leslie Valentine, is that right? Leslie, tell me, what do we do to edit this picture, to put trusted systems into the mix, if we actually believe that they're going to succeed?
Put in another kind of boundary, I would think, that would necessarily be legal, but what was
like
that?
You put another boundary and it wouldn't necessarily be a strict legal boundary, it would be more sort of a technological boundary.
So where do we put that boundary?
I would put it to the left of the legal boundary, but it's hard because sometimes the technological boundaries can almost restrict more than the law does. It varies depending on the
thing. Somewhere over here, but a technical boundary is
in a way that might be, depending on the boundary, you might want on the side.
John Birdie, what do you say?
What do I say about where to put it?
Yes. Or just how to edit this diagram. I mean, there's many ways to do it, right? There can't possibly be a right answer to this question, or a solely right answer.
My instinct would be that you can essentially put it anywhere on the diagram. I think it's more likely that it's going to end up to the right legal boundary.
It should just match the legal boundary.
No, that would end up to the right.
To the right of the legal boundary.
Yeah,
would restrict my behavior more than the legal boundary.
Presumably, yeah.
So this is basically anybody's guess. And I don't mean to set this up for there's a right answer or a wrong answer, especially because we're predicting a speculative future. Here's at least how I, as the original drawer of these things, chose to define it. I just chose to say, look, instead of drawing another boundary, which you could do, Let's just say that the technology is embedded in the range of plausible behavior in which you can engage. Right? I mean, just as the technology changed, it just naturally extended that spectrum of behavior, that orange blob. If we change the technology to narrow the kind of behavior you can engage in, the narrow, the orange blob just itself gets narrower. We manage to push it. In fact, it goes beyond the rightmost boundary of the old orange blob. Maybe you can start micromanaging your intellectual property as you get it out to the world in a way that, bless you, you couldn't do when you didn't have the technology to help you. So this is actually a possible AD 2001, right? And this is saying, thanks to the trusted system, we might be able to push people's plausible behavior so far in the right of the legal boundary, we don't even need the legal boundary anymore. Just as monastic manuscripts needed no legal boundary because there were natural blocks on each copy, so too could we somehow figure out how to deploy trusted systems, we being people interested in controlling this stuff, so that we can move the behavior over, at least push it, my word, maybe even push it so far, right, that it's further than it used to be before the era, even of promiscuous publication began. Now, of course, how far to the right do you want to push it depends what party you are. If you are somebody who's going to join intellectual property, you'll happily push it right off the end of the spectrum if you can, at least to have the option. Doesn't mean you'll use it. Maybe you'll still choose to give something away for free, think to the lifetime CD-ROM of stuff, but you at least want the option to lock stuff up tight if you can. Do you have any real-time comments or questions? There are no's. No, I hear clacking. Should I do my own view of the room for the back?
I had two from yesterday.
You have two from yesterday? That doesn't count. Two from yesterday. Well, then thank you, whoever yesterday tried to do it. Yes, a real question.
I think the other thing that you can push the boundary technologically with the trusted system to the right, but that's forgetting that the law does work on both sides. The law is protection for intellectual property, but also marks the point at which free speech concerns are going to be given as much weight as the state's willing to give it. So if the technology pushes the ability to limit plausible behavior too far to the right, then there's going to be a whole wave of free speech suits where the companies are going to be accused of eviscerating fair use, and of course they will decide against them.
So could we draw a legal boundary on this side that says the law is constraining just how far the technology
then you have, but then you have to pass these laws.
Right. So this is a very interesting claim by Jason, an important one, that says the law can not just impose constraints on us as consumers, but could impose constraints on those who would protect intellectual property. Now, it's true, pretty much, if you're a legislature, particularly on the United States, you can do what you damn well please. You pass a law, you say this is the way it's going to be, and if you put enough people in jail, maybe it'll affect behavior. And to be sure, teenagers are the least susceptible objects of law because they're stupid, they don't realize they're getting into trouble, they get drunk, and they do something they regret later, they knew it was illegal, but if what you're regulating is like BMI and RIAA, you know, you make a law, they have lawyers, they know just how to skate right along the edge. But if they cross it, you know where they live, they can't say they got drunk. And you punish them if they cross it. So Jason says law might be an instrument for helping control just where this thing lands. Yes, Marianne.
By the same token, what you're saying about BMI and such might mean that powers that they would be the powers that be. In other words, they might have more influence over where that line falls rather than the teenager whose free speech or anyone whose free speech is being contested. So there is a question about power and who's going to come out on top in terms of who's more organized or has more money to get.
I think there are two ways to sort of cast that statement. One way I call the Ralph Nader way. The other way I might call sort of the Harvard Law Professor way. So the Ralph Nader way is, oh, that's right, we're going to turn to the law to protect us. But don't you realize that the law is produced by the legislature, and the legislature is held hostage by kind of campaign finance problems, and BMI knows how to run up the hill, talk to Chairman Coble, and like talk about Chairman Coble, and just get laws passed that give them no responsibility, but at the same time give them all sorts of protection, and basically put this line over here and no countervailing line over there. You know, get real, says Ralph Nader. don't rely on the law to help you in this problem. By the Harvard Law School professor way of saying this is, there's a certain public choice problem here. Right? What's a public choice problem? A public choice problem means you don't get the legislature to do what it ought to do, which is fine, is what I think it should do. But instead, it does what other people that I think have disproportionate power and systemically are overrepresented want it to do. And to get them out of power so that the balance is restored is a bootstrapping problem. Because the point is they are in power, so that's why you can't pass campaign finance reform. Campaign finance reform is a classic public choice problem, according to the more academic way of talking about it. Are there people, where's our panel today? Is there a panel here? Why don't we get you guys in? Did you actually choose roles of some kind? So let's just, I don't know, go from right to left. Tell me who each of you is, or tell us who you are.
Venture capitalist.
Another venture capitalist, great.
I'm a consumer, or computer user.
Venture capitalist, computer user, who else do we have?
Consumer privacy advocate.
Consumer privacy advocate, okay.
I'm the artist.
You're the artist. You probably know it.
The rest of the class.
Okay, you're the artist. Yeah, how
else? I'm a legislator.
You're a legislator.
I'm the music industry.
You're the music industry. All right, so this is good. The legislator and the music industry are cozying up over here. And there's the artist. I don't know what he's doing there. But the consumer privacy advocate is out on the left over here. The consumer is just kind of having a good time. What are you again? The venture capitalist. The venture capitalist running slow, running silent, running deep. No name tag, just sort of sounding things, ready to snap up that idea before it gets to 50K competition. Very good. All right, so tell me, legislator, as we maligned you, isn't it true that you're basically in the pocket of the recording industry?
No, because the government has, as a legislator, many factors to test for, and the recording industry is over, the recording industry is only one of them. However, you do bring up a good point that with campaign finance, my allegiances may be misaligned, but I can assure you that I'm an honest legislator.
So let's put that to the test. For instance, let's talk for a moment about, as well, intellectual property and the drawing of legal boundaries. Right? We have copyright term extension. Copyright term extension is something Jack Valenti says sits lame and low on the list of legislative priorities. After all, it has already happened. And 20 years from now, it'll be high again. But in the next 20 years, we don't need to worry about it because we have retroactively extended the term of copyright for another 20 years. But why did you vote for that? Now, by the way, I know you voted for it because nobody in the U.S. Congress voted against it.
For copyright term extension?
Yeah. Honestly. This makes for a bad news conference. So you ask a question, and you kind of look at your shoes, and
I guess I just wasn't prepared for that question. I can't give you an FBI answer.
Bad staff work, so that's all for you. I used to work for the staff. Maybe the music industry can help us out.
I understand what happened. So that they voted to extend the copyright. I didn't understand what you were saying.
Yes, in fact, I think we had the webpage up at one point, which was ASCAP's question and answer on the legislative year that we passed in 98. Copyrights were a limited term, after which something protected by copyright lapses into the public domain. All of those exclusive rights vanish. The limited term started off as, 19 years it used to be, 14 years. It has increased over the years, and most recently in the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. Another 20 years was added on, such that stuff that was about to fall into public domain is now locked up for another 20 years.
I think as the music industry, the Napster phenomenon indicates why that's really not that important to me. And because things like Napster make how long a copyright term is not obsolete, but not as critical as the disjuncture between public use and the law, and something like a trusted system helps the music industry control use while at the same time catering to its consumers and not having to rely on the law.
So one piece of advice I might give you as a music industry person is that you can have your cake and eat it too. You need not choose between the legal boundary and the technological protections you want. You want it all. Get the legal boundary solid and there because it can't hurt it. You know, it's just legislative paperwork. And while you're at it, try to get the technological protection going too. So I think you may be right with the core of your comment that it's the technological protection that at the end of the day is going to save you from Napster rather than something like copyright term extension. So why give away copyright term extension as long as it's yours to keep? As a piece of advice. Lena, you're the consumer in all this, right? Are you less likely to buy a system that protects the content technologically than one that lets you copy it for free? You're thinking of buying an MP3 player. One MP3 player has the Beemit feature, so that you can walk out with your MP3 player to somebody else that has an MP3 player and just zap a song from one to the other. And there's another model that doesn't have that. Which one do you like? It's called a leading question.
Obviously, I prefer the one where I can just copy it down for me.
And as between a system that requires hours to understand, you have to go to a news group for help on it, call it a Linux-like system, but that lets you, if you just know how to push the right buttons, copy a whole bunch of stuff, and a just pay one price, you get a nice little flashy piece of equipment. It has restrictions on what you can do, but you know, for $20 a month, you can have pretty much free run of any music you like. Tell me which system you're going to buy. You're going to buy the latter one. Gotcha. I think I'm going to do one. Are there remote comments? All right, so let's hear if there are any good remote comments. Jason Marco. If the legislature pushes too far, won't the Supreme Court rein it in? So Jason is using all media to make this comment, right?
That's you, right? That's me, yeah.
Great, well, all right. He didn't want to do like a witty comeback, so he did it through the... That's great. So if the legislature, this is the answer to the public choice problem, right? Jason says, well, you know, we know that all the legislators are bought, but the Supreme Court isn't bought. They may be bait, but they're not bought. I mean, they do the wrong thing, but not because somebody's bribing them, just because they're, you know, eluding. So won't the Supreme Court protect us from this kind of thing? A very interesting question. And the way to try to answer that question is to understand, first of all, the nature of the legal boundaries that the legislature has seen fit to make. So, for instance, we take the Sonny Bono Copyright Act, which I think pretty much every legislator I have talked to on this in private, not putting them on the spot at a news conference, has said, yeah, I know, it's a stupid act. And I say, well, then, you know, you didn't even call for a vote. You know, passed by unanimous consent in your chamber. Like, that's usually resolved for, like, Arbor Day resolutions. And he says, yeah, but I'm not going to fight a battle that I can't win. And he says, who's on the other side here? You know, this is a classic public choice problem. You only have sort of consumers on the other side. So, all right, we've already established that. Who will the Supreme Court call us? Well, that's the question posed by Elder v. Reno, which I think is fair to say, as a challenge to the Sonny Bono Act, is an uphill climb. Oftentimes, a court's reaction to a First Amendment challenge to the scope of copyright is meant to say, these are apples and oranges. And you have the person challenging a particular copyright restriction saying, but it's restricting speech. If I utter the words 47 years ago, maybe somebody else has written them, could assert copyright and say I'm infringing. But if you stop me from uttering them, make no mistake, you are restricting my speech. It has to pass a First Amendment test in order to be legal. Maybe it will pass, but it has to at least be subjected to it. And oftentimes the response is, I'm sorry, those are apples and oranges. Copyright is about property, and you can't just shoehorn your piracy of somebody's property into some kind of First Amendment thing in order to get around it. I edit that dispute, that particular view that's been expressed by several courts, is not one that's because they've been bought by the record industry or something. this is really an earnest belief that this is how you carbon pie. And they are needing to see other ways to carbon pie if they're being, encouraged to think some other way about it. The other problem is, as we look at copyright law, you look at something like fair use. Is fair use in, say, the first sale doctrine, right? Remember what the first sale doctrine is? First sale doctrine is the thing that says you can lend something, you can alienate it, you can transfer it to someone else, and you won't be violating copyright no matter what the holder of the copyright says. A very helpful thing is what lets libraries exist, and it's what prevents price discrimination in the sale of intellectual property. Because if you want to charge somebody one price and somebody else another price because they've got a fatter wallet, and you've got a monopoly over the given product, that's what copyright is, you can't do it because the person to whom you're charging the lower price will buy two copies and then pass one over to the person you're trying to sell. So the first sale doctrine is in the background operating to allow libraries to exist and to prevent price discrimination. But the first sale doctrine is but a defense to copyright infringement. So if somebody infringes, is alleged to infringe copyright, you can raise a defense and say, wait, first sale doctrine, all I did was transfer the thing, I'm allowed. But it doesn't mean you have a right to do it. So as you read Mark Stefik's article for today, and Stefik quite blithely says, look how cool we at Xerox PARC are. We've designed a system that can prevent you from transferring something to somebody else. And doing this digital certificate technology that we'll talk about in a later session. But we can make it so that only certain people can view a document. In fact, only certain people can view it only so many times. And just because they can view it doesn't mean they can attach it to an email and send it to somebody else. This is blinding bullet technology. Now, do you have a first sale doctrine claim to say they're not allowed to do that to you? Typically, you don't, because they haven't alleged copyright infringement against you. Is there another, any other comments coming in? Let's see what we have here. Peter Minas says, well, there's a lot of hand-wringing going on, thanks to you, but you know, at some point, the technology converges to class participation. But normally, if you throw it up on the screen, it makes a big difference.
It's not true.
Maybe. Well, there's a lot of hand-wringing going on about how terrible it will be when owners of copyrighted product will be able to restrict use of their products beyond the realm of copyright through the use of contracts. It's important to note that the process is not driven by the web, it's only enabled by it. And he says that any publisher of a book magazine can easily include as part of a pre-purchase license agreement included on the exterior of the book any terms they like. But of course, no publisher in their right mind can do this. Market forces effectively contain this. The same could easily be the case online. Given this fact, it seems more likely that those who fear overregulation online do not so much fear overregulation, but just an end to the current free-for-all. While the old West had its romance, it may be time to move on. So, okay, I've been up here for the past 10 minutes wringing my hands quite publicly and slowly, trying to make it like an auto accident that you're going to gawk at as you go by. To say, wow, thanks to this technology, we can have a control over intellectual property that is far more thorough and complete than was ever possible through the law, which is also nominally balanced with some exceptions to the assertion of copyright. And Peter says, what's the big deal here? We could long ago, even before these technological systems, have tried to use contract to get around some of the holes that copyright law left for the consumer, and yet we don't see that. Now, I may say, you don't see it because shrink-wrap contracts on the back cover of a book are a highly ineffective way of constraining the behavior of book readers. How many book readers would actually be scared as they read a quick-wrap contract on the back of the book that says, you agree not to redistribute this book? You know, they meet in a dark alley, they hand it to somebody, they walk away, the deed is done. The dirty deed of transferring knowledge from one person to another, this sort of Prometheus-like act, can't come with a Prometheus-like penalty. Remember, you'll remember the penalty that Prometheus paid for having shared certain knowledge. I urge you to ask Beats about it rather than go into an accident-like graphic detail of what happened to him. But it's clear that the contract is either not all that effective, because it just doesn't inspire the right kind of fear. Indeed, it doesn't inspire anything. People have clicked I agree or signed car rental agreements all the time, right? How many of you have read them? So if they told you you couldn't do certain things, you would still do them. Not because you're lawless, just because you're ignorant. You just don't even know you're not supposed to do it. Yeah, Iris.
Yeah, I think the other
button,
I think the other
difference is that with the shrink wrap contract, you still have the legal system presumably balancing and making sure that it doesn't go out of control, so that they could actually choose not to recognize a contract if they think it's unfair. Whereas with the technology, unless you know the legislator decides to do what was suggested before by Jason, basically they have free rein on what they want to do.
Yes. So let's take a look at what the law has had to say so far about this technological thing. We've been presuming so far the law is basically silent on it, and you don't need it anyway as a publisher, so we can forget it and just see what it's done. But the point is well taken that as a matter of law, when you have a problem with a shrink wrap contract, the only way the contract actually binds you, except through fear, and don't underestimate fear as a means of constraining behavior, if you can get somebody to believe that something is illegal and that they'll be punished, then maybe you can prevent them from doing something. But if it actually came to a court case, you still need a court to validate. Then you get into all the classic first-year contracts kind of stuff about unconscionability and, do we really want to impose this contract on this poor consumer that, after all, was just trying to read a book and blah, blah, blah. So I think you're right, Iris, that that's another reason why contract has not been the best tool by which to do it. And indeed, there's some nascent copyright preemption doctrine that the courts have fashioned to say that copyright is meant to be a fairly exhaustive list of the sorts of rights you can claim as a publisher. And if you try to put into contract those rights that would normally be put in by a more draconian copyright law, if it just doesn't happen to exist, you're not allowed to do it. That doctrine itself has been somewhat limited. There are cases on both sides. But you can see at least the courts getting into it. So let's see what the legislature has had to say about these technological measures, and then turn to a sampling of some of the arguments that were held over the lifetime CD-ROM case to prepare for today. So here is what I call using new old rights to protect new rights. And what I mean by that is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, part of which was in your book. I actually commend the entire section 1201 to you. It is 8 jaw-dropping pages of recent legislation with which I think you should become familiar. So here's one piece of section 1201A. No person shall circumvent a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work protected under this title. And you have to wait for 2 years before it actually takes place. Because it was kind of controversial enough that they figured, let's just wait for it to happen. And by then people will have forgotten about it and then it will happen. Yes, Aaron. Use your microphone.
Does that mean that tampering with the code or whatever the actual computer program is that is the technological measure is itself a copyright violation or just a separate crime incidental to accessing copyrightable content?
So what do you think?
Well, I'm so indoctrinated by the open source movement that I think how to possibly copyright that little code thing that is the technological. And I think like that would be strange to count as a copyright violation, the actual altering of the code in order to get around the technological measure goes against these very basic principles. But as I understand, the open source people are on the outside of the law. So.
Well, does anybody else have a view on this issue? Is this creating a separate new thing you're not allowed to do in the world, or is this just creating a flavor of copyright violation? I think that's sort of the question.
Is the technological measure copyrighted by this statute?
I don't think so. I don't think this section presumes to copyright anything that wasn't copyrighted before, or uncopyrighted stuff that wasn't. In fact, if you read on in section 1201, it says quite carefully, nothing in this section should be taken to affect copyright. All it's saying is, by the way, there's a new law on the books. And the law says that. And if you break the law, you can be in trouble. Indeed, I believe, let's see if I can find this in the 8 pages, you go to jail. This is a criminal law. You go to jail if, in fact, there's also civil violations, so that the Attorney General doesn't want to try to put you in jail. Somebody else aggrieved by your conduct can hurt you. But it's also a criminal law.
So this doesn't create copyright protection for code separate from the rest of the Copyright Act's protection for content?
correct. It just says there are certain kinds of behaviors in which you are not allowed to engage. And let me just ask, how many people believe that? In fact, we should just ask, I know our panelists are playing roles, but what role are you playing again? Let's forget it. The VC, that's the least appropriate role the question I was about to ask. That's too bad. So take off your VC hat and just tell us, do you think that Jane Doe's behavior in that rotisserie question, and we can refresh your recollection, runs afoul of this provision?
I would say yes, it does.
So map it out. Make the case real quick.
She knew what the contract on the cover of the shirt back CD said, and she chose to circumvent the technological measure. Well, not circumvent technological measure, but to circumvent the agreement, or to circumvent the way the program is intended to run. And in so doing, she kind of followed up.
Does anyone
want to
defend Jane here? Did Jane spot up under this provision? Who wants to go to bat for Jane?
I don't think that this would apply to Jane's situation because she didn't infringe on copyright by reading the materials. In order to infringe on copyright, she would have had to distribute them or copy them or send them to the machine.
I don't know. That's a good question. Does this say that you have to infringe copyright in order to be punished under this title?
It says that you have to use it to circumvent copyright protection systems.
But isn't it a system designed to prevent you from getting into work and presumably then making copies of it and all sorts of things?
I don't know. I would argue that it wouldn't apply unless you're infringing copyright.
Anybody else?
Yeah. I guess my question goes to the meaning of effectively controls access. It seems kind of silly because if it effectively controls access, you can't circumvent it.
Yeah, what about that? What about that? What were you thinking? You have no theories. Well, you're a legislator. What were you thinking when you asked this?
Well, effectively within the normal means of accessing the software. By that, you know, going around what is set up in place is obviously a barrier. I mean, a stop sign should be an effective stop for people, but if people go through that, then yes, it's not effective. That doesn't mean that as a law, a person isn't violating that law by going through that stop sign. By putting in place this phraseology that effectively controls access to a work, we assumed and hoped that by having a technological stop sign, if you will, by having this code that you have to, or an authorization code that you have to chain, people would be deterred from going through that code, if you will.
So Darren, did I clear it up for you?
I guess, but not really, because I'm just wondering how...
That means no.
how technologically proficient does it have to be? Can it just be a sign, please don't click on this button, and I'll send you to all this other stuff?
Jane gets the disk, and there's just a folder that says, don't look in here. And she looks in there, and voila, all the interviews pop out. And she violated this act. And you say, well, I don't know, that's not effectively preventing them. I'm a bold button pusher, and of course I'm going to look inside the folder. So in that case, maybe you say under this law, Jane gets off the hook. It at least allows people from accidentally stumbling on stuff and gives people on the other side of the fence, those who want to protect the property, some incentive to make a good faith effort to make it work. Don't just put it in a folder that says, don't look here, and expect criminal penalties for people who then look there. Otherwise, what you are doing is exactly what Aaron was hoping wouldn't happen, which is simply augmenting copyright law by sending more people to jail when they violate copyright. Instead, we define a separate category of wrongdoing, breaking and entering. And to make it breaking and entering, you can't leave your front door open. If somebody walks in your front door and takes stuff out of your house, that still may be a separate actionable thing. But there's an added crime when they actually crimp off a lock or break a window in order to get there. John, did you have a...
I also thought the effective controls language was, in this pattern, tended to allow Lifetime to do what it did and offer samples, right? So if the effectively controls is about intention and good faith efforts to create a mechanism to prevent access, it also says effectively controls access. That's sort of the general purpose. But if you allow access to, say, three samples, it's not going to, you know, suddenly mean you don't fall under the statute anymore.
So wait, you're saying that if they allow you a few samples?
No, I'm just saying that this language allows, you know, allows LabCorp to say, you know, if it says a technology metric that controls access, you know, then somebody could make the defense that, well, you didn't control exclusive entire access, there wasn't, you know, exclusive.
I see. Yeah. So effectively is a way of making it so you can be a little loose around.
So you can tease a consumer, but then
still impose the penalty if somebody cracks into the core of stuff, as Jane in the example did. There was a question up here in this zone of the room that I really didn't.
I was just going to say that the iCreative TV, you know, click here if you're a Canadian, would be an example of a control measure that's not effective. And just anything that does effectively control access would be something that for probably 95% of the population, they wouldn't even have any clue of how to get around it. That people who are technologically savvy might have no problem, but still it would be considered effective because the vast majority of people cannot get around it.
John, that sounds pretty good to me. I'm sorry, Darren, that sounds pretty good to me. Does that work for you?
Well, it makes sense, except I'm just wondering where the 95% came from. I mean, how good does it have to be? It doesn't seem to say.
I don't know. That's what Paige judges for. You know, let them dance on it and figure out what it means. Yeah. We're legislators. We're busy. We don't have time to say how many percentages need to be working. Is that how it works?
Well, then, I don't really know if I'm somebody looking at a CD or whatever, if I'm falling within the provisions is too vague right now, unless you...
You took con law.
Yes.
All right, he's trying to use some con law weaponry here. It's too vague, I don't know what it means. And then on cross, you ask the person, well, how long did it take you to crack this CD? Well, it took me 10 minutes. All right, so it didn't effectively control it. You're okay. But if you really sweated bullets, it took you a week to get in. You can't say, well, the law was vague. I didn't know it was effectively protected, so I spent a week before it did. Yeah, John.
Well, if that's the justification for whether something is effectively controlled or not, that provides an extra incentive for bad actors in this circumstance to create really easy-to-use tools and distribute them for free.
You're absolutely right, it does. And the people who invented DMCA are a step ahead of you here. I think maybe, this is never going to work, I'm going to try to click on that and see if it actually makes it on site and has the full text of the DMCA. Or at least we get a power blast out for him. Well, they thought ahead. And they said, all right, you're right, we're not just going to have this be the only part. This is just subsection A. Let's come up with subsection B. Let me read you subsection B. No person shall manufacture, import, offer the public, provide, or otherwise traffic in any technology, product, service, device, component, or part thereof that is primarily designed or produced for the purpose of circumventing protection afforded by a technological measure that effectively protects the right of a copyright owner under this title, or has only limited commercially significant purpose or use other than to circumvent protection, or is marketed by that person or someone else acting in concert for use in circumventing protection. So we pass another thing that says it is illegal to circumvent. That gets Jane Doe. But it is also illegal to build tools whose primary purpose is to circumvent, or might have many purposes, but you sell them saying, buy this, it'll let you circumvent. It's a radar detector, code, CD-ROM cracker, and just buy it and you'll be happy. Those things are now prohibited under the law. So does that close the loophole you were worried about?
No.
Why not?
Because that goes after the author of the circumvention mechanism. It still leaves everyone who uses the circumvention mechanism in the clear, because they didn't produce or distribute it.
So you're saying, if I use a tool that makes it easy to crack programs, I then say the program is no longer effectively controlled. This is kind of the sort of thing you get into when you argue about trade secret, right? Because for trade secret, in order to claim that somebody stole your trade secret, you have to show that it's a secret. And then you effectively control it. And then you say, look, it's all over the internet. You know, you can't go out and be spreading your trade secrets. You know, it's just a formula to code, and I read it in a book, and it's on the internet. And they solve it probably here. This is a case law. We don't have a case law looking at it. The same way you solve under trade secret, which is to say, you look and see who's trying to be a weasel and who isn't, and you hurt the weasels, and you let everybody else out of the way. running only without maybe a data is concerned. Yes, here.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the reverse engineering section fits into this. It seems to say that it's okay to circumvent encryption.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, this is actually, again, this is why I commend to you a really close reading of section 1201, either on 5.1. And again, just as I read ad nauseum some pieces, I think it was of the Fairness in Music Licensing Act about the number of square feet your parking lot had to have, as an example of kind of what went into this piece of software reviews and legislation. Similarly, if you look at 1201, you'll see that there are some pieces nibbled out that are meant to blunt the sharpness of the prescription that's up here. And what happened was 1201 is sort of coasting towards being passed in a very fast legislative session. And some parties at the table raise their hand and say, wait a minute, there's a problem here. You've got to fix this. And let me just ask our venture capitalists, since we haven't yet asked any of the venture capitalists, wear your librarian hat for a minute. Tell me you're a librarian. You see this thing running towards the passage. Are you worried about this at all? Nobody has fun.
As a librarian.
Yeah.
This particular provision or the additional violation provision?
Or both of them.
Not particularly. I don't think as a librarian I would be redistributing things in a manner that isn't covered by other provisions of the Copyright Act, such as fair use. So I don't imagine that this would impact me significantly.
But doesn't this thing make it so that people can lock up stuff? This is the hand-wringing. They can lock up stuff so tight, you can't make fair use out of it. You can't just give a little chunk out to a patron. And as a result, fair use means nothing anymore.
That's true, but I think that that's been happening increasingly anyway. Most libraries pay a significant fee to use features such as Westlaw and Lexis, and the ease of access and things like CD-ROMs means that licensing agreements are where we're at.
Yes. This has been the reaction. It's a very accurate portrayal of a librarian. Most librarians are looking at this digital revolution, and the only kind of negative vibes they have, they're substantial negative vibes, but the only kind of negative vibes they typically have are feeling somehow sidelined by all this. Right? Librarians are information scientists, and they can't figure out how that passed them by. Right? So many librarians are waiting for you to come to the reference desk and just ask a question. And they can show you all the different ways to use policy to answer the question. And here's, you know, a reader's guide to periodic literature, look in there. And, you know, fewer and fewer people are coming to the desk. People are asking Jeeves instead of librarians for answers. And I just feel sort of professionally offended at this. But if you ask them, are they worried about a lack of fair use? And they don't get it. They're like, well, I don't know. We pay some use of fees, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you might argue, at least I have argued when I argue with librarians about this, there are Randy Love. This is like turning up the heat in the frying pan with the frog inside so slowly that, the apocryphal story has it, eventually the frog fries without realizing it should jump out of the pan because the grease got turned up so slowly. Becca has a little comment to make.
Thank you very much.
Good.
Maybe a couple of them?
Sure, put them down. I wish you could throw them up on the screen, but so I'll try while you read them.
Okay, Doug? Yang says, while it's true that Jane circumvented the protection, she's protected under the reverse engineering clause, since as a CS student, she can legitimately claim that she looked under the hood as a means of research. Fair use might also apply here. Marianne Hancock says, is it the oddity of this law that it punishes because there's potential for copyright infringement rather than because there's an actual violation of copyright? And Brian Hancock says, I think the DMCA is controlling distribution in a way very consistent with traditional copyright law. The technological measures are a distribution control mechanism. Defeating those measures enables unauthorized distribution.
Okay, so Brian and Marianne are over there. Hello, Brian and Marianne. And the first point is Doug Yang, who I understand is not even a law student, right? So you read the statute.
Just the reverse engineering.
I'm just curious, how many law students read the reverse engineering portion of the statute? All right. So a number of you are now claiming you did. So let me tell them what the reverse engineering provision means. Somebody who just had a hand up, come on. Yes, Jeremy.
Doesn't it just have to be to make the system interoperable with other software? So, you know, just looking under the hood, you actually have to, the reason that you look under the hood is to make the software you're looking at interoperable with, like, Windows or Linux or something like that.
The music industry seems to have a different view.
She gets all criminal encryption research, I thought, not on reverse engineering, which is the thing that we were doing that as well. Because she might be, she didn't distribute the work.
So it turns out the bottom line of this is that there are a number of exceptions in the Act that are wonderfully narrow, but if you meet the exception, you are immune from prosecution. So maybe you did hack it, but that's okay if you fall into certain categories. So what are the categories? Category one is to ask the Librarian of Congress every 3 years to consult with a bunch of people in the government in a rulemaking proceeding, talk about whether there are people who are users of a copyrighted work adversely affected by the prohibitions of this Act and their ability to make non-infringing uses. Are there kinds of people? So it's supposed to have a rulemaking, consult with a bunch of people. At the end of the rulemaking, out in the bin on the other side comes the word librarians. The Librarian of Congress has determined that librarians want to make non-infringing uses and might be prescribed for doing so by this anti-hack provision. And as a result, you are to publish the lists of the kinds of people that could be affected and kinds of copyrighted works that those people would want to get to. In other words, Metallica is not the kind of work that a librarian wants to get, so rock music isn't going to count. But maybe some kind of medieval tome of some sort may be in the right category. And if you find that, then during that time, the prescriptions of the Act won't apply to those people determined if they use it for the kinds of works that the Librarian of Congress has determined they are likely to want to use it for. Clear as mud, right? But this is an exception. And the particular people that woke up enough to complain as legislation moved towards can now come home happy because they've got their little carve-out. So that was one carve-out. Another carve-out is the carve-out that says you are allowed to do, for encryption research purposes, you can kind of sharpen your teeth by trying to crack stuff in your spare time. And so long as you crack stuff and win, you win. It's kind of like a safe fishing ordinance. You can catch the fish, but throw it back immediately and don't show anybody how you did it. And then we will let you catch fish in this national park for fishing research purposes if you abide by those rules. And thus the rules for encryption research, so long as you are doing it just for your own education, et cetera, et cetera. You can read the details in the Act. So there are a number of things like this, and yes, Jane Doe might well be able to invoke some defenses under the Act if she's creative. Of course, the question you were asked, which didn't demand that you were close reading of the Act, was just sort of an ops question. Should Jane be punished under the law, not what does the law provide? And so here's one answer to the question we picked out. Law should not penalize Jane for her actions. Lifetime is likely to develop software containing a technologically enforceable contract rather than a standard written one. So when you use technology, the producer should ensure that, like a good written contract, the technology is impenetrable. The law should not serve as a secondary rule of technology in cases such as these. Adagobia, are you here? Oh, there you are. There's a bunch of capitalists coming up everywhere. All right, so now we know your view on this. You're saying it should just be an arms race. It should be an arms race here. The record industry protects it as much as they can, and then let the hackers go to it. And if they crack it, for instance, say they crack the secret sauce that keeps digital video discs, DVDs, locked up, and they publish that crack, and they call it DECSS, a way of unscrambling DVDs so that you can load them onto a hard drive, only the hard drive is big enough. Too bad, the record industry just needs to be smarter. Is that what you
do? I think it pushes technology forward that they do that, that they crack it, and I think that economically speaking, if you know that it's crackable, you're going to fix it or people will invest in your product, you're going to run into different problems. I'm not feeling pressure.
Well, suppose I lock up stuff in my house and somebody breaks my lock and then takes the stuff. Would I like a separate law against lock breaking in addition to whatever penalty they pay for taking my stuff?
Yes, because they might have intent to do it, to take the stuff, even if they don't actually get to it. Or...
Right. So why is this the same thing?
Because I believe that contracts can supersede law in cases such as these. You can choose, you can allow, you can inform your consumer enough that they can make educated choices. And I don't think that you need to make several sets of laws to deal with that when everything is laid out in this one contract.
Right.
Legislating, I think there's a problem with over-legislation of issues such as these.
Right. Although in this case, again, often what you hear from the record industry is we want everything we need it too. We'll have a contract, but we don't need to rely on it solely as our remedy. Should Jane do something we don't want her to do? The contract is one goal of the buyer. But we're going to plead in the alternative. We're also going to say, even absent the contract, forget the contract. She's violating copyright. And after all, since she cracked the code, just like breaking the lock of the house, shouldn't she pay? And indeed, Mandy's point was maybe she's not violating copyright. Maybe she's just cracking it. We don't know if she actually got around to taking anything, but she should still be penalized for breaking the law.
I don't think she should be penalized for breaking the law in that case. I think that you need to actually have infringement of copyright. The purpose of copyright under the Constitution has to do with, you know, encouraging creativity. I think that hackers actually do encourage creativity on the part of big industry, which would otherwise just rest on its laurels and say, this is ours. You can't get it.
So this is at least an argument that tries to separate the hacker from the burglar in the house analogy. It seems to me that to be effectively countering, as you're working to do, the argument that says there ought to be Section 1201 of the DMCA, you've got to figure out how to draw the parameters of this debate so it's not about people wanting the right to kick down your door no matter how many locks you have it and then decide whether to steal stuff. And using these arguments about creativity and hackers serving useful purpose is one way of doing it. The harder argument to make about burglary tools, you know, the craftsmanship goes in to the properly honed crowbar. How can we restrict that by pulling people over when they're walking down the street like a marshal of a parade carrying a crowbar in one hand and a chisel in the other? Brian Hancock, actually, again. James should be penalized for cracking the encryption scheme and enabled the sampling thing to happen to begin with. And since encryption offers a potential for new and valuable delivery of compromised information, then it should be legally protected. And thus, we should hold Jane accountable. This is exactly sort of Stepik's point. Stepik is saying, this is great. We can make that orange blob bigger. I hope now you know what I mean when I say that. You can make that orange blob bigger, and it just allows for better and more economic combinations to happen. And if more economic combinations can happen, that's more freedom. That's less constraint, because it enhances the number of deals that can be made between mutual partners that is the basis of a functioning market in a capitalist society. So that's just my way of restating what you said, right? But I don't mean to force you to rely on that.
Well done.
Thank you very much. And the question too was, can Lifetime do that? Here's what I think Sarah Sullivan wrote. The law should not permit Lifetime to engage in this behavior, since effectively it is allowing Lifetime to make a lot of the use of clever code. Now this is interesting, because right, what did Lifetime do? It just sort of zapped her drive after she knowingly violated the tripwire. It's kind of like Petco v. Briney. This is the spring gun case, except you've been duly warned not to go into that house, and you're not, you know, shot through the chest for doing so. You just have your hard drive dismembered. And Mia writes, although the contract that comes with the CD-ROM seems like an effective way to prevent hackers from gaining access to the CD-ROM's code, in this case, technology wrongfully trumps the law. Now, that's an interesting point, because make no mistake, when people talk about contract, they're often talking about private law. What is private law? What weird phrase is private law? Almost as weird as public choice. What is private law? Private law is saying two parties can agree to a state of affairs that differs from the legal state of affairs in the world. We can create restrictions between us, and so long as we do it with some form of mutuality, the courts will pretend that that's the law. That is the law for us. we become private legislators empowered to respectively bind each other under law, and don't need to consult Congress to make it happen. That is the essence of contract. So isn't the technology that as well? And so when you have somebody like Larry Lessig say law is code and code is law, I suspect this is part of what he means. Of course, if contract is sort of nondescript, yeah, well, contract is law, and it's between two people, so why do we complain about that? We don't. Why do we have a complaint when the code becomes the law? And I want to turn to some of those issues right now. In fact, let's just skip that last one. I know we're running short on time, as always. Here's the whole presentation all over again. Let's just make it get people excited. I'm not going to deliberate again. That's what I was saying. Okay, I think we're getting close. I like those things lectures. Alright, so there's the DMCA. And what is AB 2001 then? We have legal boundary that used to be here, call that Title 17. That's copyright law as we knew it. And then we impose a new legal boundary here. And this new legal boundary is meant to, if we can use the trusted systems to move the range of plausible behavior to the right, we're going to nail it down through the use of law. That's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. It says, over to you, copyright holders. If you can figure out technology that moves this line to the right, we're going to be there right behind you to put up the legal barrier and penalize those who, through technology, try to shift it leftward again. Even though the location of this line bears no relationship to the location of that line, which was the line of copyright before you got into the technology. An interesting statement from a lot of men. Eric?
Not a member of the class has still attempted to ask a question. Isn't the argument on the other side, the people constraining, it didn't add constraint because the pipe got much bigger?
Didn't have constraint because the pipe got much bigger. Well, that was in the early phase, right? Bigger pipe meant you could copy stuff. But if these trusted systems work, that's a big hit.
Yes.
But it makes it interesting, presumably they might. If they do work, then no matter how big your pipe, you can only ship certain things through it.
Right. If that's the if.
Right.
If the trusted systems work very well or perfectly or something.
Right.
But to the extent that they don't in all sorts of media,
yes.
The pipe gets bigger than the line.
Yes, and indeed then, that's why I make this a range of plausible behavior. But indeed, there may be some hacker wizards out there, some MIT people, that are always going to be living over here. And they're going to hide out over here. They're going to copy stuff. They're going to keep their secrets to themselves. They'll be sort of an underground society of people not bounded by these trusted systems and not identifiable either. But the question is, it's kind of a 95% rule. Where will most of us be? Under this, where will most of us end up if the trusted systems are roughly effective, not perfect, at what they do? And to what extent is the law ratifying the choice to add a new layer that says if you crack the trusted systems, wherever they may choose to draw the line, you go to jail? So this is just the same diagram we have a little bit. And I ask three questions. One question, do you care who makes the boundaries? In contract, we say we don't particularly care who makes the boundaries. Two people can come to each other, arrange to make private law between them, and then we will come in and typically vindicate their choices. That is liberating. It makes people able to engage in ordered behavior with each other, to make promises they have to keep, with certain exceptions. We still have to revisit that contract. It's the very rare thing that a self-executing contract. You still have to go to court and argue in front of the judge about whether it's unconscionable. One query harking back to the UDRP is whether there are non-technological means that still end up making it so you don't get a day in a regular old-fashioned court if something goes the way you don't like. But even that is supported by a web of contracts at the end of the day in which you might be able to make a claim as unconscionable. But here you say, this boundary, the orange blob, has been shrunk thanks to the actions of private parties. Secure Digital Music Initiative, for example, is a bunch of private parties getting together to figure out how to make technological systems that can be widely deployed and go into every Sony device you might choose to buy to protect the control, to protect the copy and distribution of particular intellectual property. That's private decisions being made. So that's a private boundary that is then augmented by the public one. Do we care? I don't know. It seems like a huge shift has suddenly taken place. The typical transaction for speech used to be bounded only by the technology, which was putting it center by my reckoning, and later by this boundary here that the legislature determined should substantively exist. Here's what you can do, here's what you can't. Now you have a private party moving it. The legislature says, whatever you say, guys, we'll back you up. And there's no legislative component at all to that process. Rather odd. Even though, of course, the legislature, should it choose to, could always repeal 1201. Or one way to do it that might be nice would be to just say 1201 only applies to certain kinds of trusted systems. Certain trusted systems who build technological constraints that roughly mirror this line. If you allow certain uses, like the Versailles Doctrine, we will protect you if somebody hacks you. But if you don't allow certain uses, you're on your own. The way 1201 currently reads, you're never on your own. We'll always be there for you, no matter how restrictive you want to try to be with your content. And when that moves into a mass market, we have fundamentally altered the way we work with speech. A second question, do we care what kind of boundaries they are, which is to say what the boundaries are built of? Some of these boundaries are law, some of these boundaries are code. Should we care the type of constraint that is preventing you from easily doing what you want to do as the regulated consumer? Should we be thinking about constraints coming from law differently than we think about constraints coming from code? In the open code session yesterday, it seemed as if we were thinking quite differently about it. It was a stretch, even with all the soup and the soup labels, to be getting all exercised about open code. If somebody wants to keep a secret in their code, why not? But if you actually agreed, and you found yourself sort of agreeing to this tautology that says code is law in this case, you shouldn't care the kind of boundary, what matters is the result. What is it then if we have secret laws? If you have closed code governing this, you don't even know. It's kind of like the American Express card counts as a feature. You don't know your credit limit. It doesn't mean there's no credit limit. It just means they don't tell you ahead of time. That's a feature of the American Express card. You keep using it until you can't use it anymore, and then you reach your limit. But it's not a preset limit. It's one that comes immediately as you embarrassingly stand at Home Depot and try to buy a toy. That's secret law. That's secret constraint on your behavior. But, you know, all right, so get an American Express card if you don't like it. But there are other times when, if there was a law that says, you aren't allowed to do certain things with intellectual property, we're not going to tell you what they are. You just have to wait and see whether or not they're illegal. We would think of that as constitutionally problematic, even though, I guess by some lights, that's exactly what the common law is, right? The day before the Supreme Court of New Jersey decides an intentional infliction of emotional distress is a tort, who knew? And then suddenly it turns out if you yell at somebody too much, you could actually have to pay damages for it. So maybe that somehow gets into the penalties too. The erasure of a hard drive and having to go to jail are remedies that are distinct to their respective enforcement and constraint mechanisms. Erasing your hard drive is a technological enforcement, a technological rule. Going to jail is a legal one. I'm just laying this stuff out here because, sadly, I usually think less than a two-hour session when I'm running out of time, so I sort of fraud the finale. I'm trying to get the rest of the stuff out. Third question. Does it matter who is the bounded? Does it matter as you introspect this instant in time and decide whether this picture, to the extent you understand it, is a frightening one or a happy one? Does it matter who is the subject in this line? Right now, we've been just sticking with intellectual property. And most people, when they talk about trusted systems, are talking about the use of them to control intellectual property. But with the touch of a button, we can completely change this to be a discussion about privacy. And suddenly, this spectrum, that entity which is subject to more or less constraints, is a mass marketer, somebody wanting to sell you stuff. and the person trying to affect control over information isn't the record industry, but instead is a consumer wanting to protect stuff. If we had time, I would ask our privacy advocate on the panel today to give us a lecture about it. My apologies if you hear me right along. All I can do is share with you the following chart that I tell you immediately I did not make. This was presented to me in a secret presentation, so I'm not allowed to tell you who gave it to me, but I do get permission to show it to you. And they said next week when it goes public, we can say, see, that was the company I also wanted to tell you about. So it's a chart entitled Data Flow, and the color scheme is terrible. So maybe we should just ignore it. But let me tell you, as best I can, what this company is proposing to do. Here is you, my user, right? And you have web access, and you use it to go to an airline site. And you know, you check if you require miles, you check if the flights are, you transact at the site, you create an account there. Now, under the normal way of protecting privacy, they have a policy that just says, here's what we're going to do with your email address. We're going to give it to whoever the hell we please. That's our privacy policy. If you don't like it, too bad. Go shop another airline. Or maybe the privacy policy says something else, like, you know, we won't always do it out, but we reserve the right to change our minds, a la Amazon.com, recently, that kind of thing. Okay. So you either just choose to transact or you don't. But with a trusted system in place, we could make that a much more granular choice, exactly the kind of liberation of kinds of deals that can be made that Brian was touting for the intellectual property context. So for example, the airline could ship off your profile data to some mass marketer and make some money off of it while doing so. But as the data goes over, they don't give your name. And in fact, they don't give your email address either. They give a special, sui generis, new encrypted email address that didn't exist until the time they shipped that data over. And at that point, the marketer wants to send you junk mail. They send it to this new email address that goes through what's called a blinded email subsystem, where some trusted third party matches up that fake email address with your real email address and then passes it on the way to you. Now, what is the use of this shell game? What it means is you could instruct the trusted third party that you don't want anybody that the airline has given your email address to email you anymore. You want to retract your deal with the airline. The trusted third party says, fine. And when email comes into them, addressed to your one-time new email address that was only created at the moment the airline shifts your data out, they just refuse to hook it up with your identity of your regular email address, and the email gets lost. And as a result, you can reclaim your privacy thanks to the trusted system. This is the corresponding trick that you can use as the publisher to say, I want to be able to publish something, but not let people copy it, and then take it back if I want to retract it. And you can see doing that now in a completely different context that seems to be liberating the little guy rather than somehow squashing him or her. My paper makes more of a case about that. And are there other comments to wrap up with before we call this day?
And just to be clear with everybody about what's happening, you have until 8 o'clock to do your responses to the responses because of the network failure and everything. The result of that is that the new questions are going to be posted approximately at 8 o'clock this evening, so you won't be able to get them right away if you were rushing to post them. But they're still going to be due at the same time. And it's slightly confusing what's happening. The questions are geared towards the events that are happening this weekend. So there are four questions, the multiple choice, the three short answers. You only have to answer two of the short answers.
So I just made things a lot more complicated than normal.
It's a little bit complicated. It's all explained in the question, the first multiple choice question. So if you just read it carefully, and you only have to answer two short answers.
Yeah, the rotisserie questions this week are real in the sense that we would like to be able to use them in real time during the events that are happening next week. It's your job to read the stuff related to the event or events you're going to attend and come up with a question that has originality to it. Just like when we're hoping the papers that you're going to work on will have some originality to it. What's a question that some of these old saws, some of these people that are used to debating each other and debating issues, might not have thought about before? If you can come up with such questions, we're going to find a way to pose them join the actual events next week. We'll have the electric debate on Sunday. Oh, by the way, can I say, is anybody interested in having dinner with Jack and Lefty on Sunday evening before the debate? All right, well, a few people. We will send an email to the class with some information about that if we can gather. Jack, the Old Harbor alum, is kind of looking forward to 2 minutes. All right.